Welcome to In Context, WPKN's public affairs show. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com, and you can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. My fellow host, Gus Cantavero, can't be with us today, but I am joined by In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Due to the imminent arrival of Hurricane Sandy, this edition of In Context is pre-recorded, and we hope everyone fares well during this hurricane. So we regret that we won't be able to take your calls today. However, we will be back live in 2 weeks on November the 12th. As this is our last In Context of the month, we present our monthly War Report, where we review the latest developments in the global wars and interpret their military and geostrategic significance. To my knowledge, this is the only show of its kind on radio or TV, and we're very grateful to you, our generous listeners, for keeping WPKN independent, strong, and on the air. Marshawn, let's get right into it. This has been a very busy several days in the war. In recent days, there's been a significant escalation in the war in the Mideast, specifically. A week ago, Hamas, which controls Palestinian Gaza, stepped up its back and forth with Israel by launching 60 missiles in a very short time. Now, this attack by the Gazans set off a chain of events which has led Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to form a new war cabinet. Can you talk about the rocket attack by the Palestinians from Gaza and Israel's response?
Well, absolutely. I think what struck me most was the intensity with which the Palestinians have been able to keep up the rocket attacks ever since. This has been the longest standing Palestinian offensive against the Israeli forces and the Israeli government outside of the Gaza Strip. So it really has been a stepped up level of intensity. What strikes me the most is that I think this is indicative of the Iranian arms that are being shipped in to Gaza from Egypt. Well, actually, originally it appears the arms were getting sent to Sudan and then sent up through Egypt, through the Sinai and into Gaza. So I think it shows the Palestinians are now well-armed. The president of the head of Hamas announced that they've broken the siege. The siege is broken, which to me suggests that they've opened up the border with Egypt.
As the listeners may not be aware, Gaza has been under a very severe siege, what do we call economic siege, military blockade, for a very long time now, really since Hamas came into power, right?
Exactly. And the Israelis only allow certain amounts of food in. They actually had a cabinet meeting to discuss how much food or medical supplies one individual would need for any length of time to control exactly what goes in. And the Egyptians supported the blockade until the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak. Now that Hosni Mubarak has been overthrown, the Egyptian government isn't actively helping the Palestinians, but it's turning a blind eye to the Islamist groups that now control most of the Sinai and to the arms that are going up to Gaza from Iran and through Khartoum, through Sudan.
How bad are the conditions in Gaza? Could they be so severe that the Gazans feel they have no choice but to escalate the violence?
The situations are desperate, but I think if they wouldn't be escalating the violence unless they thought they had the arms to succeed at it. The only reason they're escalating the violence is this is part of the wider war with Iran. If Gaza stood by itself, they would most likely, because of how desperate the situation is, the shortness of medical supplies, food, and water, they would capitulate with the Israelis.
So where are these arms coming from?
They're coming from Iran, but it appears they're traveling up through Sudan. They're either being landed in Sudan or manufactured in Sudan, and then traveling up through Egypt and the Sinai into Gaza.
How much damage did the Gazan rockets do to Israel?
Not a whole lot. I mean, relatively speaking, they haven't blown up, you know, a lot of buildings. They haven't hit any major military installations, but they've killed some farm workers. They've damaged some houses. It's something that disrupts everyday life, and that's the idea.
So they can get to towns in the southern part of Israel near Gaza, but they can't get to Tel Aviv with these rockets.
No, but they're hitting Ashkelon. They're hitting the Negev Desert. What they're doing, though, is they're hitting small Israeli cities and settlements and Israeli military installations, which prevents normal life from continuing. And the potential that there might be heavier Iranian arms being stored in Gaza that are ready for use. So, you know, a larger missile, other than the Grad rockets they've been firing, could do some serious damage.
Now, this attack took place by the Gazans on southern Israel, took place while U.S. troops are engaged in military exercises with Israel. Now, I think most listeners are probably not aware that for some time the United States has had troops in Israel.
Oh, absolutely. Ever since, early on this year, when the United States was making talk about attacking Iran, we began shipping in troops to Israel. We had about 4,000. We dropped that down to about 1,000, largely because it's an election year. Obama doesn't want to look like a warmonger, so he's dropped down the number of U.S. troops. But let's not forget, these troops aren't just there for a training exercise. They're taking part in the defense of Israel. They're there to protect Israel from an attack from Hezbollah, and now there are some that are being moved south towards Gaza to help defend Israel's border with Gaza. These are American soldiers, and effectively, they're taking part in the defense of Israel. So there are also Aegis missile batteries off the coast of Israel. These are ships that are designed to shoot down other missiles that are off the coast of Israel.
So the exercises were, or as I understand it, some of the Israeli troops were taken away from this. Most of them were taken away from the exercise and sent south to respond to the Gazan attack?
Absolutely. And there's also rumor that American troops are being moved south as well. There's an American base right near Gaza where rockets were fired at today. It's the American X radar station. And it's, you know, it's American manned.
Well, the Americans are a very important part of the Israeli air defense, no?
Yes, but also an intricate part of the Israeli anti-missile defense with our Patriot missile batteries and things like that. So what's becoming apparent is that we're putting Americans into the line of fire, and I think part of it's because we see the wars going to escalate. Hamas has signed a mutual defense treaty with Hezbollah. Hamas, most people may or may not know, is a Sunni organization. Hezbollah is a Shiite organization. They've signed a mutual defense treaty. They've kind of bridged the gap, and they're both getting help from Iran. So in the event of a war, Hezbollah and Hamas will come to each other's defense, but also be a proxy of Iran against Israel.
So Hezbollah, for our listeners who may not be aware, was formed, what, about 30 years ago to resist the Israeli invasion of Lebanon?
Yes, during the Lebanese Civil War.
And it was with Hezbollah that the Israeli army came to grips when they invaded in 2006, right?
Exactly. They're fundamentally the army of Lebanon. They're very well trained, very well equipped. They even brought down an Israeli jet during the 2006 war. Now, you imagine this is 6 years later. They've had 6 years to stack up. I mean, the drone that flew over southern Israel, and our listeners may or may not remember, not that long ago, it was a couple weeks ago, Iranian drone was shot down over Israel, and it was flown by Hezbollah operatives out of Lebanon. So it's very clear that Hezbollah's military capabilities are just an extension of Iranian military capabilities. So this isn't just a small terrorist organization. This isn't the Taliban. This isn't a bunch of guys running around the jungles with AK-47s. This is a modern army, an extension of an even more modern army, the Iranian army.
Yeah, that incursion into Israeli airspace was quite a shocker to the Israelis. And I understand from Debka, a intelligence newsletter out of Israel that we cite often on this program because it's an excellent source of information in the Mideast, that surveillance helicopter may have been there to gather targeting information about the Dimona nuclear facility, which is a really key installation in Israel, has to do with their nuclear weapons program. And many listeners may not be aware that Israel is generally believed, although it doesn't admit it, to have a very large arsenal of nuclear weapons.
Well, that was Mordecai Vanunu, and anybody can look that up. Mordecai Vanunu was the man who broke the story of Israel's nuclear arsenal.
And this is going back many years.
This is going back to the 70s,
Israel's 80s. Never acknowledged it has nuclear weapons.
Israel's never acknowledged it. In fact, they abducted Mordecai Vanunu from Italy, which to me is a testament of truth. If the guy was just a lone nut saying, Israel has the bomb, Israel has the bomb, and they just thought, he's nuts, we really don't have the bomb, why would they abduct him from Italy, you know?
And
take him back to Israel.
Debka also suggested that a target of the surveillance by this Iranian surveillance helicopter out of Lebanon was the American X-band radar station in the Negev.
And that was the one I was talking about earlier, which is manned by Americans. I think that in the event of a war, well, What Iran's preparing for is they know we're coming for them. They know we're coming for them. They know that Israel's coming for them. Israel has formed a war cabinet. And a war cabinet, okay, well, just to backtrack a little bit, there are going to be Israeli elections in January. Now, rumor had it that Israel was in a very precarious situation. This goes along with much of Israel's strategies before a war, pretend to be in a precarious situation from which they cannot actually launch a war. In reality, it's nothing like that. There was supposedly a break in Israel's government. Didn't exist. Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister of Israel, and Netanyahu supposedly had a split. They've now formed a coalition, the ultra-Orthodox party of which Avigdor Lieberman is the head, and Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party have formed a coalition. Now not only are they guaranteed to win the Israeli elections, but this coalition has already formed a war cabinet, according to Haaretz, the main Israeli newspaper, for preparations to an attack on Iran. This would be tantamount to the New York Times having a headline saying Obama enters war room to plan attack on Iran. Israel is clearly planning the attack. They're planning for after the American election, because I think we've put it off, we've made them put it off long enough. The problem now is that Iran has had all this time to prepare. So what Iran's going to do is through Hamas, through Hezbollah, they're going to hammer the Israelis, hammer the Dimona plant, hammer American troops in Israel. And then while Israel is incapable of responding to an attack or the U.S., we're going to all pull in to defend Israel. At the same time, Iran would invade Kuwait and eastern Saudi Arabia. They're all their troops, and this isn't just speculation. The Iranian army has been training in offensive operations for the last 6 months. That's, again, another article in Debka, but you can look this up. Iranian army trains for offensive operations, and they train using amphibious aircraft. Amphibious sea craft. My guess is what the Iranians are going to try to do is, in the event of war, they're going to sweep into Kuwait, and they're going to cross over the Persian Gulf, not at the Straits of Hormuz like we think they are, the narrowest point. They'll go straight across the Persian Gulf after hitting our fleet and land in eastern Saudi Arabia. If they controlled Kuwait and eastern Saudi Arabia, coupled with the fact that Iraq is a Shiite-dominated country and therefore an Iranian ally, Iran would effectively control one half of the world's entire oil supply.
And one of the vulnerabilities, I understand it, of the eastern part of Saudi Arabia is that it is a predominantly Shia area, correct?
Precisely. They don't have to worry about an insurrection against their troops. In fact, they'll probably be viewed as liberators because the Shiite population has been oppressed by the Wahhabi militant Sunni Wahhabi regime that runs Saudi Arabia.
As we've discussed before in our show, it's really important to understand the religious breakdown in Islam to understand the geopolitics of the region. Iran, a large Shiite power, opposing Saudi Arabia, whose regime, autocratic regime, is propped up by the Wahhabis, who are the most Islamist group in Islam.
Militant group.
They really do not tolerate other forms of Islam as well. They're not well intentioned towards people who are outsiders, but they don't like other Muslims, right?
Oh, absolutely. They don't even like other Sunnis who don't adhere to their very rigid form. But I think one of the things, so what's very important to realize is that, so you have, and a lot of the Saudis might be frightened of an Iranian invasion, but in eastern Saudi Arabia, they'll probably actually view them as liberators. So now, taking that into consideration, if Iran, through Iraq, controls the Iraqi oil fields, and then through an invasion of Kuwait and eastern Saudi Arabia, while we're busy trying to protect Israel from Hezbollah and Hamas, Iran will effectively control not just the Persian Gulf, but one half of the world's global oil supply. The other majority of the world's oil is, get this, under Siberia. So effectively, Russia, which is also an Iranian ally, Russia and Iran would control virtually the entire world's supply of oil.
So now this is really playing for the big prize. I mean, back in 2001, according to General Wesley Clark, our Defense Department, our secretary then was Rumsfeld, drew up a list of 7 countries that we were going to take over. And we've taken over most of them, but the biggest prize in that list was Iran, which has the largest reserve of natural gas in the world. And together with Russia, the two of them are they're the 1-2 of the of natural gas and oil in the globe.
Well, yes, and not just that, but if you control Iran's oil, Kuwait's and Saudi Arabia and Iraq's oil, you now control over half of the world's oil supply. So the key here for Russia, again, Iran's a Russian military ally. So in the event of a major war, Russia stands the most to gain. China stands the most to gain, too. China has a mutual defense treaty with Russia. Russia has a mutual security treaty with Iran. What? So in the event of a major war, the Russians have everything to gain. We have everything to lose. And a lot of people say, well, Russia, you know, why would they back Iran? Iran's a weak military power. Folks, go and look it up yourself. I can tell RIA, Novosti, Debka, Haaretz, these are all reporting, Russia Today even, reporting how Russian arms are flooding into Iran, Russian advisors are flooding into Syria. They're determined, the Russians are playing for the big prize now. Their big prize is that if they can kick us out of the Middle East in a major war, they will control the world's access to oil, which also means Putin said in his manifesto, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, said in his manifesto that he who controls the world's access to natural resources controls the world. So this is where this man's mindset is at. His ideal is not to have troops in Washington, D.C. His ideal is to control everybody's access to oil. So then he can say to the Americans, well, I don't like what you're doing. I'm going to turn off the lights.
And the recently, William Engdahl, who's an excellent historian we've had on the show a couple of times, based in Germany, wrote an article about the natural gas factor, how it's changing in the Middle East. Apparently, there have been recent discoveries in several places in the Mideast, including offshore Israel, in Syria and Qatar, which are tremendously increasing the natural gas reserves of the region. And this happens at a time when Europe has decided, particularly Germany, to shut down its nuclear plants, and it's going to be moving away from coal because of its CO2 emissions towards natural gas. So it becomes very, very important to the Europeans and to the Russians as well as to who's going to control these new oil, natural gas fields.
Absolutely. And I think to a great extent, the world wants to go off of nuclear power. Fukushima really rattled everyone. I mean, the fact that you were getting radiation levels in California, I think, really frightened people. So natural gas seems like a great solution. And when you look at the Middle East, both the oil and the natural gas is very close to the surface. So you don't have to do the fracking that we do in the U.S., which is breaking open the ground.
So the environmental problems here, and I just saw recently Connecticut is looking to get involved in the natural gas fracking. And there's so much opposition to it here. And I think from what I've seen, very well-founded concerns that it poses a threat to our water supply, drinking water supply.
But that's why the Americans, that's why when people say, well, you know, why are we so aggressive in our defense of Israel or in our policy towards Iran, it's because what keeps us right now from having to do fracking in Connecticut is the fact that we are going to be the hegemonic power in the Middle East. The problem is if Russia and China are the hegemonic power, Russia, China, Iran, that axis are the hegemonic power in the Middle East, we will be at their mercy. No amount of oil in Alaska will dig us out of that one.
The Engdahl article also mentions an important event which I've seen, which has been overlooked in our corporate media, which was that a year ago, Iran, Iraq, and Syria signed an agreement to construct a pipeline from the Iranian-controlled gas fields in the Persian Gulf through Iraq to Damascus, the plan being to extend the pipeline to a Lebanese port from which port it would go to the European Union. Now, of course, if this comes through, it's going to put Russia and its allies in the Mideast in the driver's seat with respect to the European Union. And it brings an analogy. We've often talked about analogy between the present powder keg situation in the Mideast to World War I. And in World War I was largely caused because of the Berlin to Baghdad railway. And this railway, which was almost completed on the eve of World War I, would have made the British Navy almost irrelevant because the German Empire would have been able to take oil right from the Persian Gulf and bring it all the way into the heartland of Europe over a land route. So to heck with the British Navy. And of course, one of the reasons why the British really had to get that war going and why it started in the Balkans was that was the missing link in this crucial pipeline route.
And I think that's where we are right now. We're terrified that the Russians, and again, you know, this isn't just, some people want to make more oil money for their compatriots. In reality, what we get down to, and this is why the U.S. government has such a vested interest in controlling these oil routes and these natural gas routes, if we lose control of the Middle East, if Iran and Russia come to dominate the natural gas and oil routes of the Middle East, not only will the United States become politically irrelevant in the world, but we will also be at their mercy. Meaning that if China or Russia decide that we're not playing ball, you know, China says, hey, listen, we need to settle 1 million, 3 million, 10 million people somewhere. We want Utah. And we say, nah, we don't want that. We don't want to comply with your foreign policy or your economic tariffs or, you know, whatever they want us to do. they'll say, fine, we'll turn off the lights. You know, we will stop the flow of gas to your country. Gas will go up to $10 a gallon. So really what we are looking at is the powers that be in the U.S. are looking at the survival of the United States as a superpower. If we lose the Middle East to Russia, China, and Iran, we lose our superpower status. We will become a second, if we're lucky, a second-tier power, if not an utterly irrelevant power.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the War Report, our monthly War Report on the series In Context. In Context is on WPKN every Monday from noon to 1 p.m. We're normally live taking your calls, but unfortunately, due to the imminence of the hurricane, Hurricane Sandy, we were pre-recording this show, and we're not able to take your calls. And we hope that everyone fares well and is safe and dry during this this coming hurricane. One of the items you mentioned earlier was Sudan, or one of the details was that there were weapons coming out of Sudan that were being involved in the Mideast. And didn't Israel recently stage an aerial bombardment outside Khartoum in the Sudan?
Absolutely. Now, Israel neither confirms nor denies this, which if Israel doesn't deny it but doesn't confirm it, that's same as an admission of guilt, you know, in my opinion. Because every time Israel does something like this, you know, they say, well, we may have done it, we may not have done it. But all the evidence points to the fact that Israel bombed this weapons factory in, even the American press is saying this, but this is in Haaretz, the Israeli press, is in Russia Today, Press TV. The Israeli Air Force came and bombed this weapons factory because this weapons factory was making Shahab rockets manufactured from Iran, from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, on behalf of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, to be shipped to Gaza to be launched at Israel. So the Israelis are trying to stem the flow of rockets. What the Israelis are really trying to do is they're trying desperately to hold a lid on the pot that's boiling over until after the American elections. Because they know until the elections are over, we will not intervene in their defense.
There's been this elaborate dance going on between Obama and Netanyahu for months. The Israelis pressing us to beginning to go ahead with an attack on Iran. But evidently, Israel is afraid to do it on its own. Do you think that Israel, after the election, is going to go ahead on its own and just figure the U.S. has no choice but to join the attack? Or do you think there'll be some kind of an agreement between Netanyahu and whoever the president is after the election?
Absolutely, I think there'll be an agreement. I mean, both Obama and Netanyahu say all military, Obama and Romney, you know, you start to wonder what the difference is. Obama and Romney, the only difference fundamentally is that they say, well, we're not going to launch a military option right away, but it's on the table. It's on the table. And Romney says, I will not allow Iran to get nuclear capable. Obama says, I will not allow Iran to get the bomb. Obama actually on a phone call to Netanyahu, according again to the Israeli press, Obama said Iran will have 4 to 6 nukes by March. Well, what's this tell you? This means he's saying, if I win re-election, I will have, you know, I will have the excuse to go to war. No matter who becomes president, they're going to go to war. And because, not because of Iran's nuclear weapons, and not because Israel will attack without us. They're going to go to war because they're terrified that Russia and Iran will control the world supply of oil and natural gas. That is the fear. We know that if we lose this war in the Middle East, we will become a third world power. We will become irrelevant. We won't even be a power within our own hemisphere because Iran and Russia have allies in South America. Bolivia, Venezuela, even Brazil and Cuba are all allies of Russia and Iran.
You know,
so if we lose the Middle East, we become a third world power.
It's very ironic because America has been over the last few years regarded as the world superpower, yet we're kind of at the brink of losing our superpower status.
Well, that's why we are, in many ways, the best analogy I find is we are like the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We still want to fight for the empire. We still think that we can push our way through. We still think one last gamble, one last desperate gamble, and we can have it all. And that's the way the Austro-Hungarian Empire felt at the outbreak of World War I. They felt one last desperate gamble, and they'll control the Balkans. They'll kick the Russians back, and they'll control all of the Balkans and, you know, everything north of the Ottoman Empire. And Germany was a young superpower, but the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which really sparked it off, was a old one. And they thought one last desperate gamble. And that's what we're thinking. Right now, we're looking at losing everything because, let's face it, we've made adversaries, although this was a long time coming because the last time to make peace with Russia was during the Cold War. We failed at that. So what we have now is we are in a position where either we voluntarily give up the Middle East to the Russians and Iranians and accept being a third world power, or we make one last desperate gamble to control, to keep control of the Middle Eastern oil and natural gas routes and staying a superpower.
It seems to me that this is a road we started down in 1991 when President Bush Sr. invaded the Persian Gulf. And it seems to me that he blew the opportunity for global peace, because under Reagan, we had bankrupted the Soviet Union and they pretty much surrendered. Gorbachev, with his glasnost, acknowledged, you know, they're a disaster in Afghanistan, that they couldn't continue to oppose the United States. And I think at that time, there was an opportunity for a great international reconciliation. But unfortunately, as soon as Bush Sr. came into office, he started to contrive this war over Kuwait, which was really just an excuse, I think, to establish a permanent military presence in the Persian Gulf.
I definitely agree, but I think
Russia was pretty weak too.
That's true too, but I think had Reagan had a third term as president, you know, if he'd been allowed to, I think one thing you would have also seen is we would have reached out to the Soviets, because that's one thing, you know, Reagan did very successfully was reach out to Gorbachev and say, hey, you know, reach across the line. I'm your friend, not your enemy. Whereas now, what you had in 91, Reagan steps down, Bush becomes president. What happens now is we take a very hostile stance towards the Russians. We work with Yeltsin to topple Gorbachev and the Soviet government. We work with Yeltsin to destroy and dismantle the Soviet Union. And so,
in a very corrupt way, with all these oligarchs ripping off their state enterprises.
Oh, absolutely. So we made an enemy of a people we should have made friends with. And because of that, once we'd done that, once we dismantled the Soviet Union, there was no going back. And that is when we look at our hostile relations with Russia. That's where it started. Because when the Soviet Union completely fell apart, Russia became poor, people were starving, bread lines, all the rest of it, there came an anger. And you know when this happened last time? Because folks, there's a historical precedence for this. When did this happen last? Let's think back. 1918, Treaty of Versailles, Germany. Why did you have the Nazis in 1933? It was a response to the shame of the Treaty of Versailles. We did the same thing to the Soviets. That's why you have Vladimir Putin, an ex-KGB guy, and a Russian imperialist in power in Moscow.
So this is the legacy of the early 90s, or the 90s, the dismantling of the Soviet Union and saddling them with these corrupt oligarchs who are really helping themselves to a lot of money, but also helping outside Western bankers.
Absolutely. And so now what you're seeing is the Russians have decided they want to get their own back. And again, folks, I can't reiterate this enough. I'm a student of history. I'm a historian. I've studied history in college, but I've also studied history independently. And there's nothing new in history. People have told me this in conversations I've had with people on the street. Oh, the Soviet Union fell in 91. Russia's weak and corrupt. And these are often people who grew up in the 90s. Russia's weak and corrupt. But let's look back at Germany in 1920. Everybody thought Germany was weak and corrupt. The Weimar Republic. Who would have thought in 1920 that by 1935, Germany would have a first-rate army? In just 10 years, a little more than 10 years from that, like, you know, let's say we go from 1920 to 1935, 15 years, Germany goes from being a third world country to a superpower. Now let's look at Russia. 1991, Russia collapses, Soviet Union's gone, and 20 years later, Russia is now more powerful than it's ever been. Its military is more advanced than it's ever been. Its computer parts are manufactured by Chinese engineers. They manufacture their own surface-to-air missile systems that can hit down stealth planes. They were the ones who helped the Iranians reverse engineer our stealth drone. So we can't look at them and say, oh, these are the guys from the 90s. They're not the same people.
I just read that the Moscow recently deployed advanced S-400 interceptor missile batteries to the southern military region opposite Turkey. So this apparently is a challenge to NATO, because for two reasons: Turkey is threatening to create a no-fly zone in Syria, which we should talk about, and because the U.S. is forming this supposed anti-missile defense system, which is clearly targeted against Russia, although we say it's against terrorists.
It'd be like if the Romans were to say Hadrian's Wall was to keep the Welsh out of Scotland.
Well, now you said earlier that it's very important to look at all the players and how everything is connected here in the Mideast. Syria is closely allied with Iran, and it's also been sponsored by Russia for a long time. What's going on in this uprising in Syria against the Assad government?
Well, what's happening now, and I think this is one thing that's greatly distressed the American and the Israeli leadership and the Turks, has been that in spite of all the arms we've been sending and the fact that we've even sent Al-Qaeda militants to Syria, we've supported Al-Qaeda militants. That's how desperate we've been to overthrow Assad. In spite of that, Assad's won. Assad's won. The rebellion's over. He's just destroying the rest of them piecemeal. And why? Russia shipped in thousands. We're not talking a couple hundred. Thousands, something we're in the ballpark of 30,000 Russian Spetsnaz Marines and SOBR, elite police counterterrorism units, guys who are veterans of the first and second Chechen wars, guys who've been fighting in the guerrilla mountains. I mean, these guys are not just, you know, a bunch of conscripts. They've been fighting a guerrilla war in the mountains of Chechnya against Chechen rebels since the 90s. So these guys have been sent into Syria, and they have soundly thumped our rebels. And so now that we've seen that happen, now that the Turks have seen that happen, that's the reason why we're stepping up the preparations to attack Iran, because I think we're realizing very, very quickly that the Russians are willing to commit themselves wholeheartedly.
Looking at it from the military point of view, we need to take out the Syrian government before we attack Iran. Otherwise, we're going to have a two-front war at least. If who knows what Iraq is going to do, because they're a Shiite government that could well be neutral. Who knows which side they're going to go on.
Well, the Iraqi, and this is something, again, this is an RIA Novosti a couple weeks ago. Not in the American
which
press.
Is what?
It's a Russian news website. It's a Russian news agency, but it focuses very heavily on national security. And RIA Novosti had a huge article about the Iraqi head of the Iraqi Joint Chiefs of Staff going to Tehran to sign a joint security pact. It also had an article on the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki signing a $4 billion arms deal with the Russians for surface-to-air missile systems and attack helicopters.
If you just joined us, my name is Ken McDermott Rowe, the name of the show. I'm the host of In Context, and I'm speaking with our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe. This is our monthly war report where we take a look at the global developments in the global war. A lot of them, important developments, are not reported in our corporate media, and we not only report on them, but we try to analyze their geostrategic significance. And we've been focusing on this whole escalation of violence in the Mideast, which started just a week ago with 60 rockets being fired by the Palestinians in Gaza into southern Israel. That's precipitated a response by Israel breaking up a training exercise with U.S. and Israeli military forces, and many have been allocated, including Americans, to the southern border of Israel to counter this threat. We've seen Israel launch a bombing attack on Khartoum, a bomb factory in Sudan just outside Khartoum. And we're also seeing and now discussing the deterioration of the U.S. NATO-backed uprising in Syria, which Debica said a few days ago, our own Western intelligence people now feel that the rebellion is going to fail, that they only have about less than 30,000 rebel soldiers in the field. And this goes in the face of the fact that for many months now, Hillary Clinton has been pronouncing the death of the Syrian government and the imminence of a new U.S. Backed regime in Syria.
Absolutely. And I think something to mention in connection with all this is the shipping of U.S. troops from Eurocommand to Turkey to take part in, they say, the defense of Turkey, but also one of the articles I read said that the troops there will assist in the defense of Turkey, but also the implementation of a safe zone for the transportation of humanitarian aid. I'm putting air quotes. I know our listeners can't see that, but air quotes, humanitarian aid to Syria. So these American troops are going to be in harm's way with the Turks. Now, I think what we're getting around towards is the war's already started. Iran and Syria and the United States were all fighting each other through proxies, but we're starting to creep in a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And I think what you might see sometime soon, if American troops are in the line of fire this close, all it takes is a Syrian mortar or a Hamas rocket to hit an American patrol or an American radar station and kill four or five American soldiers.
And when that incident happens, we won't even know if it's a false flag operation. It could be like the Gulf of Tonkin, which we found out later on, the pretext for the Vietnam War was fabricated.
Exactly. It could be like the Gleiswitz incident where the SS staged an attack on a German radio station and left a bunch of dead concentration camp victims.
This is 1939 Poland, and then the Germans could claim that they'd been attacked by Poland, right?
Or alternatively, we could see something like the Marco Polo Bridge incident, which took place in the 1930s in China. The Japanese wanted an excuse to launch an invasion of mainland China from Manchuria, so they sent patrols really, really close to the Chinese, and somebody fired a shot. Nobody knows who fired it first, but Japanese troops were in the line of fire, and they said, see, we've been attacked by the Chinese. So again, it's entirely possible that whether something's completely staged or whether we're just putting our people in such close proximity that we hope somebody will get attacked so we can have an excuse to go forward, both are equal possibilities.
We also have troops in Jordan, don't we?
We have troops in Jordan as well, taking part in operations to keep the Syrian army out of Jordan, since it's so obvious that the Syrians want to invade Jordan. It's really, we are setting up ourselves for a major war. The question is, what's going to spark it off? The best analogy I can think of is, it's like if you imagine we're all sitting in a room full of gunpowder and we're all smoking cigarettes. Whether a falling ember sets it off or somebody intentionally flicks a burning one into the gunpowder is anybody's guess at this point. But something is going to spark it soon. It just has to.
So the way it's lining up, it's what, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, these are kind of our protectorates, Bahrain. Many of these are autocratic regimes. In fact, none of them are democracies. So they're lining up on our side. As you mentioned, Qatar has been bringing these Al-Qaeda fighters into Syria, which is very ironic since we're supposedly having this war against Al-Qaeda.
Well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
These are the same Al-Qaeda fighters, apparently, that we used to overthrow Gaddafi in Libya.
According to Russia Today, are using nerve agents against the people of Bani Walid. You know, these same people that we're now sending into Syria are also using nerve gas against the citizens of Bani Walid, which was a Gaddafi stronghold, but now just inhabited by unarmed civilians.
I don't think there's been any coverage of that in the mainstream press. Have they seen anything about it? But apparently it's a horrendous number of civilians are being killed there.
Oh, yeah. Well, the U.S. press has done, I mean, this so-called transitionary government has committed genocide against the blacks living in Libya. You know, I mean, the people we backed are committing genocide against any form of Gaddafi supporters, and this includes blacks. They do not like blacks because the blacks in Libya predominantly supported Gaddafi, and so they're just killing blacks. And, you know, I think one thing that people need to understand is this isn't getting reported in the U.S. press because no administration wants to go in and say, well, okay, we backed a bunch of genocidal maniacs and now they're killing a lot of people. Let's just pretend that part's not happening. And also, it would mean we had to do something. It would mean we would have to intervene.
But even the New York Times said there is no effective government in Libya anymore. It's just a bunch of armed militia groups.
Exactly. If people knew the humanitarian crisis that was going on there, people read the foreign press, what they would say is, well, we toppled Gaddafi's government. Now we should step in and stabilize the country. Well, they don't want to do that. All they're concerned with is keeping Russian and Chinese oil companies out of Libya and controlling the Mediterranean. So
Course, there's the great game again. When Gaddafi came into power in the late 60s, he kicked the United States military out and he invited the Russians in. So we've never liked him.
Exactly. But so now what we're trying to do is we got rid of Gaddafi. We don't care who's there now. All we know is they're going to keep the Russians and the Chinese out.
And the Chinese, of course, were there in a big way.
Oh, yeah. The Chinese had massive oil contracts there. Now that's all gone down the drain.
Thousands of Chinese had to leave.
But what's going to happen now is we're not concerned with what happens in Libya. What we're concerned with now is how the situation in the Middle East plays out. If we drive the Russians out of Lebanon, Gaza, Syria, and Iran, we control, as I've said before, the world supply of oil and natural gas, at least over half of it. And then this way we've secured our place as the world superpower. Now, China and Russia will still be rivals. China doesn't have any oil of its own, nor does it have natural gas. Russia has oil and natural gas, but without that Middle Eastern oil, they're only self-sufficient. Lose their stranglehold on us in Europe.
Now, of course, you mentioned China. They're very interested in getting oil out of Africa. How would they play into a wider Middle Eastern war if the major powers start to have a direct confrontation? Iran, Russia on one side, and then NATO and its local client states on the other side.
China could go one of two ways. China could either stand in the background, figuring they'll watch us duke it out and bleed each other dry, and then they'll step in afterwards and be the world's only remaining superpower like we did at the end of World War I. or alternatively, what the Chinese might do, because the Chinese aren't interested in having an empire outside of Asia. They love business deals in Africa, but they're not interested in having an army in Africa. What I think they're inclined to do is when we and the Russians are bleeding each other in the Middle East, they'll eventually step in, and I think that's when they're going to seize the natural gas and oil resources of the Pacific. That's why right now they're having a confrontation with the Japanese. They've seized a series of Japanese islands. These are Japanese islands. They belong in Japanese territory. The Chinese have seized them, and they told the Japanese, if you try to send your Coast Guard to these islands, we will sink your ships.
Are they known reserves?
They're known natural gas reserves. That's the only reason the Chinese are interested in them. The islands are fundamentally tiny. They're ugly islands. But what the Chinese want is they want the natural gas that's in the territorial waters of those islands, because China lacks natural gas. And we haven't backed up the Japanese. But I think there will be a point when the confrontation gets bad enough, maybe near the middle or end of the war, China will step in, and maybe they'll steal more islands. Maybe they'll even go declare war on us just so they can take some more of the Pacific. But
Obama recently announced an important shift, an emphasis in our military and our Navy towards the Pacific. This has a couple of implications. Do we have enough left in the Middle Eastern area to fight a war with Russia? And even with the additional forces in the Pacific, do we have enough to fight China?
China could field, if it wanted to, an army of 350 million men. That's from the CIA fact book. 20 million Chinese men and women reach military age every year, which means if we were to fight a war against the Chinese, we would have to kill 20 million a year in order to stem their tide. This says, this is where President Obama made a very naive comment during the debate. He said that, we don't need tanks and ships. I mean, back during World War I, we had horses and bayonets. Well, let's face it. We still have bayonets. The last bayonet charge was in Afghanistan. The last cavalry charge was in 2001 when Special Forces took Kandahar. And at the end of the day, for all of the fancy schmancy aircraft we have on board that one aircraft carrier that's off the coast of the Philippines, if the Chinese can field 30 submarines, that one aircraft carrier, or they can field 100 planes for every one of ours, or they can field 1 million men for every one of ours, all of the F-22 stealth fighters in the world will not force multiply enough to combat that. So the Chinese are in a very strong position. The only question is how much they want to get involved. A factor that's important for the Chinese is that a war is not necessarily in their worst interest. They'll bankroll us and they'll bankroll the Russians. So we'll keep borrowing. The Russians will borrow. And then, of course, China gets to expunge some of its surplus manpower because they have way too many people. And the leadership is very Machiavellian. They would not be beyond, exterminating a portion of their male population to reduce the overpopulation in the country. So China, I mean, there are a lot of reasons. And then, of course, the grab for the natural resources in Asia and the land grab, because they need land. China would have every reason to get involved, whether directly or indirectly. But they have no reason in stopping a war. And certainly our military force in the Pacific is a laughable deterrent at that. Most of our ships and troops are in the Middle East. The show of force in the Pacific is a complete joke.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context, WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. In Context is on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m. We're normally live with call-ins, but due to the imminence of Hurricane Sandy, the show is pre-recorded. And we look forward to being back with you on 2 weeks from now, November 12th, where we will be live and taking your calls. President Obama's statement during the debate that you alluded to does indicate the mindset of the American leadership, which is what high technology, drones in particular, are going to be what wins the war of the future. Do you disagree or agree?
I completely disagree. Technology has always been important, but let's face it, the atomic bomb didn't help in Korea. What it came down to in Korea was bullets, bombs, and hand grenades, not atom bombs. And the fact is that when both sides of nukes, both sides of stealth planes, the technology plays a role, and a very important role. Technology only eliminates the need for troops, though, when you're fighting people who are in the Stone Age. But if you fight a power that has an equal military, e.g. one who can shoot down your stealth drones, now you need troops, because now you're fighting man for man. Because what technology is what's known as a force multiplier, meaning I don't physically have 100,000 troops, but having 10,000 troops and a certain number of stealth planes and, drones and this and that, multiply the number of troops I have on the battlefield, multiply that number by 100. So it's called a force multiplier. The problem is that force multiplier doesn't work when your enemy can shoot down your drones and planes. Now 10,000 troops only equals out to 10,000 troops. And that's where Obama's living in a fantasy world. Obama's fantasy assumes that we're fighting somebody who's weaker than us. If we're fighting an equal military power, having planes and drones and stuff won't matter. Because they'll have all the same things. What will matter at the end is who can field more men, better trained, and better equipped.
Recently, in fact, just Sunday, October 28th, Hamas launched something called Grads at the Dimona reactor in Israel. Okay, is this a modern weapon, a very modern weapon?
No.
What is this?
The Grad rocket, or missile if it's guided. It's rocket is unguided, missile is guided. I've been around for, probably since the Cold War. And so this technology is very old hat. And that's part of what makes it harder to combat, is that the Iron Dome that we set up with Israel, which is Patriot Missile Systems, again, the latest in anti-air.
Iron Dome is what, a U.S.-sponsored air anti-missile defense system for Israel?
Exactly. It's Patriot Missile Systems. It's, all kinds of anti-missile systems. Which is great in theory if the enemy's launching one big old scud. But if they're launching 1,000 or even just 60, if they're launching even just 60 rockets at a time, the computers can't target that many at once. Maybe you shoot down 10 out of 60.
So even though these weren't sophisticated missiles, many of them got through to Israel.
Exactly. The reason why these anti-missile batteries were so effective during the 1991 Gulf War was because Saddam launched one or two Scud missiles at a time. The reason why they were so effective in 2003 is because Saddam launched one or two Scuds at a time.
And he was in bad shape because he had been the victim of many-year embargo.
Yeah, but even if we're going back,
antiquated equipment.
Even if we're going back to the Gulf War in 1991, when he had his army was drained by the Iran-Iraq war, but leaving that aside, he hadn't suffered the embargo yet.
Yes.
So if we go back even then, if you're launching one or two Scud missiles, which are big, big land-to-land, surface-to-surface missiles, if you're launching one of those, they're easy to shoot down because it's just one. But when somebody launches 60 missiles at you, the Patriot missile system has never been tested against that, and it's failed. The Iron Dome system would work if Iran was launching one missile, but if Hamas launches 60 mortars and rockets and missiles, these Patriot missile systems don't work. And that's a perfect case of Obama's quote-unquote technology wins out being wrong.
So could you see the Americans committing a large number of troops to a war in the Middle East, in Israel, Jordan, Syria?
I think we'll have to. We'll have to, because if Iran, like I say, if Iran can seize eastern Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and through a Shiite-dominated government control Iraq, they control half the world's oil. At that point, unless you're willing to go out there and drive, electric cars, or you're willing to go without, electricity in your houses for a while.
Of course, there's really no excuse for us to be in this position. The first Arab oil OPEC oil embargo was in 1973. That's what, 39 years ago, and we still haven't figured out a way to run our cars without using oil. Jimmy Carter saw that it was a huge crisis back in the late 70s. But one of the themes of In Context is we shouldn't have our public policy determined by large corporations whose only interest is short-term profit. Our public policy should be determined by the American people, for what's good for the people and what's good for our national interest. And what do we got? We have a military policy designed to benefit oil companies. We've got an energy policy designed to benefit oil companies. And if you look at other aspects of our domestic policy, you see a similar pattern, a healthcare policy designed to benefit insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies.
Well, and how much sense does it make that our entire nation's survival should be dependent on foreign oil? But that's what I'm saying. If Iran controls eastern Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iraq, and Russia, again, if it controls the whole Middle East because they kick us out, what we are looking at is the point where people can't drive their cars or get electricity or heating. It shouldn't have to come to this.
Well,
we should have an alternative policy.
Marshawn, we only have 5 minutes left in the show, but let's quickly take us through a scenario where this thing gets out of hand, where let's say there's a steady escalation in violence in Israel. There's, say, a false flag operation or some real incident. and the fighting begins between Israel and Iran. U.S. will have to come in. What would Iran do? Would it attack our ships in the Persian Gulf? But what? Where are the targets?
Iran has made its statement that in the event they are attacked by Israel, all American military interests are legitimate targets, meaning that whether we go along directly or not, they'll hit our ships. And the first thing they'll do is they'll use their Qaeda anti-ship missiles launched across the Persian Gulf, which have plenty of a range to hit our ships. They're low flying. They're almost invisible to radar. They'll fly close to the water, so they'll fly under the radar but above sonar. Pretty brilliant. Based off the French Exocet missile that worked so effectively during the Falklands Wars. And these are domestically made. But they'll launch those at our ships. They'll hit our fleet in the Persian Gulf. And after disabling our fleet, because our fleet's packed in real tight, they hit our fleet. Then they'll send troops and ships across the Persian Gulf and land troops in eastern Saudi Arabia. At the same time, they'll most likely invade down through Kuwait. And the first thing they have to see is within the first week of the war, ideally within the first 72 hours, is eastern Saudi Arabia. Because then then domestically, that's hitting us at home, basically. Because domestically, now gas prices are going to skyrocket overnight.
What's our response if they were to attack an aircraft carrier? What could we do about that?
Well, ours would be to launch a counterattack on Iran. The problem is that we would want to launch a counterattack with missiles and aircraft. Well, if they can shoot down our missiles and aircraft and they have stealth aircraft, if they have stealth aircraft, like we've seen they have, because they reverse engineered our stealth drone, and that's how they made that one that went into Israel. If they hit our air force and our carriers before our planes can take off, we have no response. The only thing we can do is hope to send enough troops and tanks to stem the tide of the Iranian invasion.
Wouldn't we be able to take the U.S. be able to take out Iran as long as the Russians didn't intervene in a big way, or no?
No, because the Russians have funneled in a tremendous amount. I mean, they have that. Well, gosh, by now they might have close to 100,000 troops there in Iran. They have surface-to-air missile batteries there. Russia's committed into Iran all the way. So it's not a matter of if Russia decides to get committed. They're committed. The only question is when we decide to call it
and
quits
how about
or
the
try
Europeans?
To break a deal.
How about the Europeans? Like the Germans, I think, frankly, they would be crazy to get into war with Russia. They need Russia for natural gas to heat their homes, and they're so close.
Germany doesn't have a choice unless they're willing to kick out 150,000 American troops.
Which are stationed in
which
Germany.
Are stationed in
so
Germany.
That makes the Germans involved on our side, whether they like it or not.
Exactly. Now, contrast that with Britain. Britain, which has always been our longtime ally, has decided to deny us the right to use their bases for an attack on Iran. So Britain clearly doesn't want to get directly involved. France wants to get direct. Well, France may or
France
may not
would like
get,
Syria back.
France wants Syria back. That's
and
a
Lebanon
big thing.
Would be nice.
And
too.
Lebanon would be
which
nice.
Which used
yeah.
to be their colonies.
Exactly. They're not really interested with necessarily an attack on Iran. Pretty much, in the event of an attack on Iran, it's going to be us, the Turks, and the Israelis, and our Emirate allies. And we're going to go it alone. The biggest question will be, can we mobilize enough troops quickly enough to stop them? Because when it comes to technology, if they can match us plane for plane, or if they can shoot down our planes or shoot down our drones, that is when it goes back to horses, bullets, bombs, and bayonets.
Well, to come back to the original theme, we are really on the verge of a global confrontation in the Mideast, especially involving the United States, NATO, and Russia, and Russia's ally Iran. And I don't think that the corporate media is getting this through to the public, how precarious our situation is. I didn't see any appreciation for it when I watched the debate between President Obama and Governor Romney. They just seem to be on the same military expansion track. They don't seem to be aware of how dangerous the situation is.
Neither of them have ever served in the military. Both of them have no concept of the danger they're putting the American people in. And to be fair, the American people don't have a concept of the danger that they're in right now.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Marshawn. Thank you very much for this explication of the geostrategic situation in the Mideast and all these important developments that just aren't getting out in the mainstream media. And we thank you, listeners, for supporting WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, for your generosity and keeping this independent, non-commercial station on the air. In Context is on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month, when our manager, Steve, reports to the listeners. We will be back with you on Monday, noon, November the 12th, and I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about because somebody's going to be president. It's going to be Romney or Obama. We'll be live, and we want to hear what you think about the election.
And stay safe through the hurricane. And I also forgot, I would like to mention to any of our Muslim listeners out there, happy Eid al-Adha.
And visit us on incontextreport.com or on YouTube, our YouTube channel, In Context Report channel. So thanks very much, and we will be speaking with you in 2 weeks. Take care of yourself during the hurricane.